This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 109 was recorded on June 15th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. I'll tell you how to claim a free copy of their new guide to the best investing books ever written at the end of this episode. Joining me today is GavCal co-founder Louis Vincent Gav. Louis, I want to start with a subject that's near and dear to both your heart and mine, as we are both legal residents of Hong Kong, although neither one of us spends full time there. There's a lot of coverage in the press saying, okay, this is pretty much the death knell for Hong Kong. A lot of wealthy people in Hong Kong are looking to move out. There are a lot of people saying that what's really going on is China is going to kind of accelerate the pace of the agreement, which originally allows them to annex Hong Kong completely into the People's Republic of China in 2047. A lot of people are saying maybe they're going to do it 20 years earlier than originally agreed, or 25 years earlier, as the case may be. Is that really happening? Is it all over for Hong Kong? And particularly, what about Hong Kong's future as kind of the liaison between Western finance and the Eastern economies? A lot of people are starting to say, hey, Shanghai is all that China needs. Hong Kong is over and done with. What's your take?
Thank you again for having me. It's always a great pleasure to catch up. It seems that, you know, you and I catch up every 6 weeks to 2 months, I think, and I think last time we spoke was an exciting day with oil going down to minus 40. And, you know, we might have felt at the time that the world couldn't get more troublesome and more hard to understand. But, of course, a lot has happened in the past 6 weeks. And as you point out, one of them is what's unfolded in Hong Kong. Now, my business is headquartered in Hong Kong. I've spent the past 20 years of my life there. I've actually lived in Hong Kong more than anywhere else in the world. My four children were born there. So, obviously, you know, when you look at the troubles unfolding in Hong Kong for the past year and a half, the challenge when you're so knee deep in it is to set aside the emotions, set aside, you know, the gut feel that you have about everything, and to try to look at things objectively. Now, of course, you know, the emotions, the gut feel, nobody is delighted to see China basically grab Hong Kong with a firmer hand. To your point, what made Hong Kong always very special was its role as a bridge between East and West. And seeing China basically put that potentially in peril is, you know, emotionally, you want to react. Having said that, you know, I think, you know, at GavCal, we don't run a human rights advocacy group, and our clients don't pay us to grandstand on political issues. Our clients pay us to analyze and invest and to do so with a clear head. Now, you just made a very important point. You said, you know, isn't Hong Kong going to be taken over by Shanghai? And I think a year ago, or up until 3 months ago, if you'd asked me that question, I would have said that's a very real risk. For if you look at the timeline of Hong Kong, the troubles started a little over a year ago now. And through the past year, Xi Jinping was as quiet as he could be on Hong Kong issues. In essence, the message coming out of Beijing on Hong Kong was, this mess is being created by Carrie Lam, and it's up to Carrie Lam to clean it up. And so Xi Jinping was trying to distance himself from Hong Kong as much as possible. This has obviously been turned on its head in the past month. What you've seen in the past month is Xi Jinping basically saying, okay, I now own the Hong Kong problem. The Hong Kong problem is mine, and I'm going to solve it. Now, why did he do this? You know, he's got enough problems on his plate. Why go out and seek the ownership of yet another problem? I think the answer here is pretty simple. Xi Jinping is obviously a very ambitious president for China. You know, he's made no qualms. He hasn't hidden his objectives to turn China into a proper empire an imperial force over the 21st century, the whole China dream and China 2049 and all that stuff. And he knows full well that to do so, he needs a reliable capital markets. Now, if you look at the past, 6 months, I think you've had two very key events. The first was the Alibaba IPO or secondary offering. Shanghai lobbied extremely hard to get the Alibaba IPO, but basically couldn't pull it off. And so the secondary for Alibaba went to Hong Kong. And then, of course, starting a couple months ago, you started to see U.S. politicians of both the left and the right, for being anti-China is probably the only bipartisan issue in the U.S. You start to see politicians of both the left and the right saying, basically, Chinese companies shouldn't have access to U.S. capital markets anymore, and that the Chinese companies listed in New York should, in essence, be kicked off the New York Stock Exchange. And so if you're Xi Jinping and you hear this, you think, okay, well, I need a capital markets. Shanghai isn't ready. New York is shutting down for me. That basically leaves only Hong Kong. And if Hong Kong is my only choice, then I need Hong Kong to work. I need Hong Kong to be a success. I need all these demonstrations to stop. So I've got to basically tackle this problem. And so while I think in the Western world, the perception is what's happening in Hong Kong is massively bearish for Hong Kong, I think if you're there, you see it somewhat differently and you think, okay, the coming years is going to see a tidal wave of Chinese deals. It's going to see a tidal wave of more RMB bond market deregulation using Hong Kong as the base. And you're just going to see money pouring in, which is why, you know, if you look at recent weeks, the Hong Kong dollar in recent months has gone from the lower end of its trading band to the upper end of its trading band. And it's been stuck there now, really for the past 3-4 weeks, really since Xi Jinping's announcement, it's been bumping to at the upper range of its trading band. And every day the HKMA has to go into the market and sell Hong Kong dollars and buy US dollars, because otherwise the Hong Kong dollar would break out, not on the downside, which is how so many US fund managers saw this path, but instead on the upside. And so for all the talk about how, you know, the Hong Kong dollar is going to go down, et cetera, right now the central bank has to prevent it from going up, which of course then means more liquidity for the Hong Kong market and is usually good for Hong Kong asset prices. So I think away from the political noise, I would caution your listeners to say, well, look, right now, if things are so bad in Hong Kong, why is the Hong Kong dollar so strong? If things are so bad in Hong Kong, why is the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, the company itself, continuing to make new highs? So I think there's a key difference between what you perhaps read in the press and the underlying reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is Xi Jinping now owns Hong Kong, and he needs to make it a success.
Louis, speaking of topics that are near and dear to Xi Jinping's heart, let's talk about the U.S. dollar. A lot of people, myself included, really thought that this coronavirus crisis was going to cause a lot of flight capital to flood into U.S. dollars, causing the dollar to appreciate. And, you know, we've been proven wrong a little bit excitedly for a couple of weeks there. The dollar was really taking a nosedive. Seems to have stabilized a little bit. But what's going on here? And what do you see on the horizon for the dollar?
You start off with the COVID crisis, which, of course, is where we have to start off, because this is, of course, the biggest economic shock in our lifetimes and even before that. When you face a big economic shock, I think the first question is, how do policymakers deal with this economic shock? And what's pretty obvious with this COVID crisis is you've had central banks that have decided to, in essence, monetize the economic pain, and central banks that, and other central banks that haven't. So, for example, you know, in China, you've seen, for once, compared to, say, 2008 or 2015, this time around from China, you've seen very little monetary printing. And so, you know, if you look at it on this framework, in fact, this is somewhat similar to the oil shock of the early 70s and the late 70s. There were, you know, the two oil shock of the 1970s. What you saw is that some central banks at the time monetized the oil shock. Those were basically Britain, the US, and France. And they ended up having very weak currencies for the following decade. And then some central banks didn't, Switzerland, Germany, Japan, and they ended up having very strong currencies for the next decade. today, if you look at, you know, forget the 70s, and but use that framework of reference to look at what's happening today. And today, no central bank is being as aggressive as the Fed. I take your point on saying, well, look, you know, it's a risk-off event, so I expected the U.S. dollar to go up. But why, honestly, why should you expect the U.S. dollar to go up when the Fed balance sheet is increasing by over $3 trillion in just as many months? When U.S. M2 is growing by 23.5%, which it has never done in history, and the second fastest growth in M2 anywhere in the world is China at 11%, but China is always between 8 and 12% anyway. The growth rate of U.S. money, broad money growth today, is basically 10 times the structural growth rate of the U.S. GDP. This has never been seen in history. You know, the growth in U.S. budget deficits and the growth in U.S. money supply, you know, to me is so gargantuan that, you know, if you just think of the world in terms of supply and demand, if you have a Fed that says, you know what, tell the U.S. government, you go spend as much money as you want and I'll give it to you. And at the same time, it tells pretty much every foreign central bank out there, if you need dollars, just come to me and I'll give them to you through the swap lines. Why on earth would you ever expect the U.S. dollar to go up? You know, if a price is the interaction of supply and demand, what the Fed has just told us is there is infinite supply of dollars. And, you know, so why would you expect the price of something where the supply is infinite to go up?
And of course, one of the possible causes of the weakness in the U.S. dollar has been this big outbreak of civil unrest in the United States, which is now spreading all around the world. Is that being driven by the killing of George Floyd, or was George Floyd really just incidental to a bigger picture? If so, what's the bigger picture?
Look, there's no doubt that the horrific riots we've seen all across the U.S. are not bullish the U.S. dollar. If anything, you know, at the margin, that's another reason to sell. I think if you're a foreign investor and you think, you know what, I like to invest in the U.S. because I've got ultimate safety of capital and I can keep my assets there, et cetera, and they're safe. But you see the kind of looting and the kind of capital destruction, it, of course, undermines the logic there. But even beyond that, I think if you're a foreigner and you see what's happening in the U.S., the bigger question behind all these riots is, I would say, almost a societal question in that, you know, our societies, I don't know if you've ever read Hutchinson's Clash of Civilization, but, you know, Hutchinson basically goes through the 9 major civilizations that the world has gone through. And what makes ours very unique is basically the rejection of collective responsibility. You know, our entire legal systems are based on the idea of individual responsibility. You are responsible for your own actions. You are not responsible for your father's crimes. You are not responsible for your brother's crimes. You know, in many societies, if your brother committed a crime, then you could be punished for it. You saw this under in China under Mao. You saw this, of course, in Nazi Germany and so on. The idea of collective responsibility for something is basically the path down to hell, frankly. What is amazing in today's demonstrations is that what has come out and what I find extremely scary is that you have all of a sudden the idea of collective responsibility for things that happened generations ago. The idea that we can be responsible for the crimes of our fathers. And once you go down this path, that's basically the path towards totalitarianism. It's the path towards the breakdown of law, frankly, of law as we know it. So, you know, these riots, behind these riots, I think it's something very, very scary. When you come from a countries that have known socialism, that have known the idea of collective responsibility, and all of a sudden you see that emerge in the U.S., which, you know, for anybody was sort of the shining city on the hill, the idea that, you know, this is the one place in the world where individual rights will always prevail. And all of a sudden, you see all over the U.S. this clamor for collective responsibility. As a foreign investor, it is scary. And you think, well, you know what? I've seen this movie before and I'm taking my money out. So I do think there is some of that going on for sure.
Well, Louis, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. We look forward to getting you back on Macro Voices soon for another update. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following strategies, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.